All right, good afternoon. Excuse me. Good afternoon, everyone. It is 1:04 p.m. on Tuesday, November 17th, 2020. This is a work session, a legislative discussion meeting among staff. I'm Commissioner Brian Crotius, joined by Commissioner Julie Fedorchak and Commissioner Randy Christman, as well as John Shu, I should say, to make it official, and Brian Johnson from staff. And Dean, are you going to chime in? Do we have, and then I don't know, do we have anyone on the phone as well?
We don't have to go to Dean, we just have
from staff. Oh, okay. Okay. Well, then I think we're ready to get started. Jack, are you going to lead the discussion?
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you.
So, if you remember, in a previous meeting, we had stakeholder discussions, and we got a lot of good suggestions from various members of the industry and some of their concerns. As a result of that discussion, I made a number of changes, which I'll kind of outline today, and we'll walk through. Most of them aren't very substantive or very large, but you know, I think they had some really good input that was useful in changing some of the drafting language. I spoke with Commissioner Christman specifically about how we wanted to introduce these bills, and we ended up, as it is right now, putting it down into six bills, and that was the second sheet that I handed out to all of you. It just kind of lists it. First is the mining renewal bill, then the meter testing, the IRP. Bill 4 is the siting law changes, and it has 4922 and 4922.1. We separated off two specific sections relating to wind issues for bill number 5, and that those two are the light mitigation technology and the repowering section, and then the last one is one call. But we can come back and as we go through all these and have some further discussion of really if that's the strategy the commission would like to take, or if we wanted to even further split or put some of these bills back together. Start off, we can move to Title 38, and that should be the top sheet that you have in the packet and what I sent out to all three of you. And if you recall our previous iteration of this, I believe we had the permit renewal period, and previously was 120 days, and we were discussing whether to move it to 150 and also 180 days. And my understanding is there was some concern of moving it all the way to 180 days. And so this most recent draft I provided as of today has 150 days as the change. But Dean sent out a form and a chart to all three of you, I believe, in the last couple of days that provides more of an illustration of the difference between the changes and the impact it would have regarding the 150 days and 180 days. And I'll just have Dean walk through those.
150 days, I guess it's an increase, and the more I thought about it, that I wasn't sure 150 days was going to do much in light of us also increasing the time to request an informal conference or to schedule an informal conference, changing it from 30 days, what it's currently approved, to 45 days. And when we do that, the 150 days really doesn't buy us anything. So what I did is I made a comparison between what we're currently at 120 days with 30 days to schedule an informal conference versus 150 days with 45 days to schedule an informal conference and 180 days with 45 days to request an informal conference. And again, if an informal conference isn't requested, it's really doesn't matter much, but if an informal conference is requested, the time frames for providing public notice and scheduling that on 150 days, we're up against the clock again. So you can see, you know, if all the timelines run out, we're 30 days behind. On 180 days, we come out, you know, right at zero. And then just for comparison, I used the Coyote Creek revision number 9, renewal 1, the thing that's really bringing this to calling attention to this. And that was submitted 154 days in advance of expiration, and we really ran out the clock there. So,
Dean, maybe you can describe at least your interactions. I know you spoke with a number of members from the industry.
Yeah, I heard from BNI, and they were fine with either 150 or 180 days. And this morning I spoke with Jessica Unruh or Bell. And she said they preferred 150 days primarily because the amount of time that it takes to that application is out there. So I did share this with her. And when she looked at it, she said, yeah, I could see where 150 days wouldn't be buying us anything. We'd still be up against the clock on that, especially with increasing the time for scheduling an informal conference from 30 days to 45 days, because there we've taken up 15 days of the 30 days that we've added. And as you see under the current system, we're in a deficit. It's just simply not achievable.
An increase from 15, from 30 to 45 was important too.
Because we have to publish 2 weeks in advance. And with, county newspapers, with their publication schedule, really out of that 30-day period, only leaves us probably the last 10 days in which we can schedule something to meet that. Whereas by going to 45 days, at least gives us some flexibility. Like the one with Coyote Creek, we just literally couldn't do it. And all the parties had to stipulate to extending that deadline. I'm sorry, which?
On the 150 days.
Mm-hmm.
You've added 30 days to the current, right? You've added 30 days more.
Right, mm-hmm.
And then you've used up 15 of those by the 45-day.
Mm-hmm.
Where did the other 15 days go?
It is only 15 days difference, I believe, at the end. On 120, it comes out minus 45. On 150 days, it comes out minus 13 or minus 30. And, well, let's see. Yeah, I see what you're saying.
I think the answer is that under the current, we're running a deficit of 45. So going from 30 to 45, that would make it a minus 60. So if we go to 150 days, that does 30 of it, and we're still 30 in the hole.
I see.
And so going to 180.
Commissioner.
Yeah.
Did you want me to repeat that?
All right.
Would you?
Not a big deal, I guess.
Thanks, Matt.
So I guess I just wanted to tee that up for discussion to see how the commission wanted to proceed. I thought that gave a fairly good illustration of a possible need to move it to 180 days.
Didn't OSM have a problem with 180? Wasn't that the issue with 180?
OSM, I've informally run this by them, and they're fine with us changing these two dates, primarily because SMACRA just says within reasonable time. It doesn't specify time. We also requested to change the scheduling for a formal hearing from 30 to 45 days, but SMACRA does specifically say 30 days, so they said they would likely not approve.
That's what I'm confusing.
So,
is that what I'm confusing it with? I knew one of them put the kibosh on something.
Yeah.
Okay. So they're okay with 180 or 150?
Right.
And so we're adding 60 days.
Like I say, it's macro just says that
half
a reasonable time. And
yeah. Are these Are they not knowing these plans more than a half a year ahead of time? Is that a problem? Like, can the mines use this and still be able to function, or how far in advance are they planning for these kinds of?
Yeah, you know, it's a 5-year permit term, and we do a pre-renewal review that goes out prior to them submitting the renewal, and we identify the things that need to be updated. And some are pretty standard: ownership and control information. A lot of the things are standard, and then anything else that we notice that, you know, requires updating, and they identify the next 5-year coal removal, but that's pretty well known in advance.
So is it hard for them to get, like, I guess the 180 days, does that put the mines in a pinch for getting their work done that far in advance of what they're applying for?
I don't think so. Right now, informally, we're sending out we've bumped up the schedule, and we encourage them to submit. First, it was 150 days earlier. Now we're suggesting 180 days, and for the most part, they're doing it. But they could say, well, it's not a requirement. I don't have to submit 180 days. But for the most part, they realize what the problem is. It's not a problem unless we have an informal conference. That's the kicker, is the informal conference that really pushes everything out.
I guess it seems sensible to me. I don't know. But, Randy, do you support the 180?
Well, you said that BNI was fine with either. You said that North American's representative said they understood why we wanted to do this. Well, I mean, if we submit something and they're just going to change it, then maybe we want to rethink changing the informal part or something. But so what did you mean by will they support this, or do they just understand why we would?
I'm not sure.
Do they like being crunched for time?
Pardon?
I mean, doesn't this put them in a difficult position when, or is it mostly us because we have to respond?
It puts us, you know, it could put them, you know, if we come down to the wire on, you know, permit renewal, that everything isn't done. I don't know what we'd do. I mean, we've never had to cross that bridge, but.
We were pretty darn close on that last.
We were awful close on Coyote
the last
Creek.
Couple days,
as you can see there, it went down to.
Yeah.
The day it expired is when the new one was approved, and it.
Well, I appreciate this chart, and as far as I'm concerned, I'm fine with switching this bill back to 180 for now. But I think I want to do some feeling out a little bit. And we might have to revisit this before we file bills.
I guess I don't necessarily need to have another meeting. I'm okay with 180 or 150, whatever you guys think is the best and is most likely to get passed.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no sense bringing something that a key player is going to be against because you know it's going to fail.
Yeah, and especially if then it conflicts and makes our other problem worse, and the 15, the 30 to 45 passes, and I don't know. But why don't we plan on, if that's all right with you, Mr. Chairman, we'll make it, have Jack switch it back to 180, and that'll be our plan for now at least, okay?
All right, moving on to the second bill, and this is the bill on testing meters for electric and gas. Remember, this is the whole shall versus may discussion. After that lengthy discussion, we changed it back to shall. Please the commission.
Yes. Small victories.
That was a big one.
We still
give it about 10 years.
They did run for office
back again,
for some reason.
Give it time.
I don't think we have to have too much discussion on that one. Moving on.
It's not.
I think we may move on.
All right, moving on to the third bill, and this is the IRP statute, and really nothing has changed since the last discussion, but I do know that there is one issue that Commissioner Crispin would like to discuss regarding the funding.
Yeah. So I was talking to Wyoming commissioner who, you know, they just had a pretty significant case regarding an IRP.
Mm-hmm.
And in that case, there was actually some coincidental savings for them because DOE did a big study and that provide on that specific case, and that provided them some information they didn't have to gather themselves. But outside of that, their consultant cost $300,000.
Jeez.
I had Victor visit with that consulting company, and I wish I had this in front of me. I think they said they range like from $150,000 to $400,000.
How long was, like, was it for, what was the complication with this particular plan? Was it for one company that serves all their customers, or how, what was the?
No, it sort of reminded me of the situations that we have here. It was, and I don't remember the names of these companies, but it was a company that is either a subsidiary or a partner of another, and they're both multi-state companies. And the one that serves customers, and this was a case about, serves customers in Wyoming and I think Utah and one other state. And then the other one also serves several states, maybe a little further north and west or something like that. But, you know, their plan was a lot of changes away from baseload power to either renewables or market, and just an overall assessment of what the by the commission to make sure they understood what the impacts to that kind of change were going to be on the customers in Wyoming.
And did a lot of it have to do with the closing of those Wyoming facilities, bunch of their coal generated facilities?
I don't know how many, but there were closures involved, yes.
Of virtually their entire fleet. So
of that company's.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I don't disagree that this is, you know, that they're probably going to be expensive, but was there more issues beyond just the resource mix serving those customers in that case?
You're getting beyond what I know about it, but I don't know if Victor knows any more than that.
So I don't know how much you've talked about so far. I guess I haven't been tuning in to listen, but the experts in that Wyoming case, they were, Wyoming operates a little bit differently than we do. That was primarily a report they gave to staff, and it's advisory in nature rather than an advocacy type of role that we'd probably be looking at here if we were to have such a situation. With that in mind, they did say that...
Is your mic on?
What's the report about? What was it a report on?
The report was making recommendations about coal and carbon capture being a better alternative to intermittent resources. As far as from a cost perspective over the long term, I think that was kind of the gist of the document. And as I said, it was primarily report versus testimony. That was one thing the experts that I discussed this with, if we were going to ask them to provide both written and oral testimony, then the cost would be increased versus a report or simply some ideas about how... You know, what types of resources to look at.
Okay.
I
so
really
what are you
think
proposing,
that.
Randy?
Pardon me?
What do you want to propose?
Let me just give one background on it. When when I was in the legislature and I heard numbers floated around for filing fees on rate cases, and I was used to my electric co-op where a board gets together and just decides what this is going to be, you know, and it just seemed like absurd figures. And now that I'm here, I understand how we use up or need the resources to do that kind of an assessment. And so whether we put $175,000 or $500,000 in here, it's going to be shocking to most legislators. I think that the Wyoming case gives us a good basis for why this needs to be a lot more. Whatever number we put in, they're probably going to scale back. I think that based on that, that this number should be $300,000 or $400,000.
Do you think there's any merit to the idea that the bids will come in at whatever amount we have? Because they can see that in the law.
I think Victor would be good to address that, but at least in my experience, they usually move up towards where the value that we are able to provide.
Right.
I would agree with that as far as bids go. You know, we have rate cases and ADPs. You know, right now is a good example. We have four RFPs outstanding for, you know, varying amounts in the low $100,000 range that we know is low based on some responses we've received from some of our experts for doing a rate case, but we still get bids. So I guess to me what that says is we will always get people to bid on those lower amounts, but they may not be the quality that we would like to see.
Yeah.
So that's just something to keep in mind. I don't know, I'm not saying whether one is right or wrong, but
Depends on what you need as with consultants. Because a lot of times staff will do part of it themselves, or we have in the past, and then we'll just get specific consultants, and then it usually is a little bit cheaper. So it depends on our needs for each specific case.
Are these consultants, when it's a consulting firm, is it usually a one person or two people that are working out of their home offices, and that's their firm?
We've seen a variety. I think the smallest company that we've worked with is probably about three people. But some of the larger firms we work with, there's probably two to four primary individuals working on a project, and then they will have up to 10 or 20 people assisting them with them, with research or writing different kinds of reports.
So you may not know the answer to this, but the entity that has three people, do you know how many cases they handle a year?
I have no idea.
Could you guess? I mean, just based on how much time that would probably take, I mean, are they doing four or five of these a year, 10 a year?
That small of a company is probably not doing 5 or 10. I would be surprised if it was five. Five is probably a high number for that small of a company, depending on the type of case. You know, a rate case is going to take more time and resources than an advanced determination of prudence, for example.
I think one of the questions that will come up on this, well, a couple of them, you know, it's the legislature will look at the numbers you're suggesting as staggering. And I think the question I would ask, okay, so then what exactly are you going to do with it? And if the companies are paying that much, what do they get out of it? You know, Jack, we talked this morning, and it's probably more of an elimination of components that just aren't in the ballpark or something that we'd consider, but certainly don't want to go so far as to have it be viewed as a form of approval that might come back later and hamstring us on something.
So one approach might be to sit down or touch base with the four companies and say, what would you support, what level? Because, again, if they're behind us, it's probably going to be fine. If they aren't, we're probably not going to get it. So if they're saying, no, we understand, this is a tough market, they won't be able to get good experts for less than $300,000, and we think that they should have the resources to do it, then the legislature probably isn't going to fight it. But if the utilities come in and oppose it, then they probably will.
Well, you know, they're usually pretty supportive of getting us resources that they need, that we need, for something like a rate case, because they're seeking something, and they know that we need to gather our own neutral body of information in order to justify approving what they want. Here, the best thing for the companies is, like we are now, where we don't have any resources to challenge IRPs, so we just file them, and there they sit. The worst thing for them, I really think for the company it was the best thing, but in their minds, I'm sure that company in Wyoming is regretful that they had the ability to get that information, and frankly, that case isn't even done yet. They just haven't approved it so far. So when they've decided, you know, let's say one of our companies decides, yeah, we're just going to go all renewables, and somehow or another we'll get power on not good days for intermittent sources. And we want to challenge that. Well, if we don't have resources, we can't really. And so they're, I expect, going to talk this down, and it's going to be up to the legislature to decide whether they want us to be able to take a look at these kinds of things, or if they want Minnesota to do it.
Well, except for the fact that they've already seen this and supported it. So I guess my question to them would be, how high, like, at what point do you not support this anymore? If we say 250, 300, 350, up to 400, at what point does your support go away?
Yeah.
Because they've said they think they recognize this. I mean, Otter Tail and Xcel even said it's a good idea, and Xcel has been kind of advocating for this through that RTF for a while. Man, we might be able to close that case.
I think Xcel would like an answer that wants they're looking for the same type of action from the North Dakota Commission as the Minnesota Commission, which approves the IRP, which I don't like that approach. Here, you know, one of the thoughts I had when I look at this, okay, $175,000, and say one person could analyze two IRPs in the course of a year, which seems reasonable. Victor's shaking his head the wrong way.
you're thinking one guy?
No, I said one person. Or maybe I said...
You said one person. So are you thinking one company?
No. Or? I'm just thinking out loud, and sure. That is... What if we just hired another person on staff and their job was to do this, or to do two of them in the course of the year and rotate the companies so every several years, and then utilize that person for other things and save a ton of money versus outsourcing all of this cash to another entity? I mean, when we're talking about $300,000 to get it done.
Thanks, Steve.
Times three companies. And let's just say we did each company once every 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
That's still $900,000 in a biennium. Or do you hire another analyst on the advocacy side for the commission? But and see significant savings overall. And if we're not going to approve them anyway, and they're finding that the defective parts of the IRP, you know, weeding out the bad mm-hmm. stuff. It just seems like an enormous waste of money to. I'm amazed at how much these companies can charge, and they're in short supply.
I think that's probably the key. I mean, having someone on staff who's capable of doing the research and testimony for an IRP would take some time. I'm not saying that we couldn't find someone who's capable of doing it. They just wouldn't be ready, I think, for a while, most likely.
Even, in, as you said, they're in probably tight supply as it is. It is a unique skill set, and especially when it comes to the modeling, and there are multiple types of software that each individual would have to be able to know how to use, because each utility company runs separate modeling software. I could tell you that specifically Adam's been working on one for a very long time, over a year at this point in time, and I think we're about to probably get a memorandum very soon, probably within the next month, based upon that. But I could tell you the amount of time and the modeling runs that he has done just to get to the point before Xcel Energy switched software, that he had to start over again and learn a whole new modeling software. It's very difficult. And on top of that, he's using the company and trying to work with the company to get this modeling. In an ideal world, we'd have a group of individuals that would actually be able to run this separately by themselves. So we wouldn't have to ask them to make these changes, run it for us, and get back to us. And instead, the company itself would probably use the software like Compass, do an evaluation based upon what they feel the input is required, and come out with an independent suggestion.
Maybe the state should have a state-owned consulting firm, and we've got an elevator, we've got a bank, have this and do it. Utilities across the country and make the taxpayers tens of millions of dollars. Wait a second. Never mind.
I like the idea. I'm on it.
I've never thought it. Randy, what were you thinking you wanted to do with this? I'm not opposed to trying to ask more. I think the best approach would be to ask the utilities how high they go and then go with that number, just as the most practical. But
I mean, my thought based on the Wyoming case and then the conversation with that consultant was that it should be in the $300,000 to $400,000 range. So to me, I think that 175 is too far from that for us to think that we're going to be able to do a good job of these. And really, the worst thing we can do is start approving these without thoroughly analyzing them. That's worse than not doing anything, in my opinion.
And we haven't really even gone down to what it is we're going to do.
Right.
We can just provide feedback. This seems questionable. I don't think anybody's thinking like we're going to go through and redo the whole IRP and say, here's your new IRP that we approve of. Like, that is a lot. And we may not even look at some of it.
But I'm sure that when they're not controversial seeming, the IRP comes in and we're going to pretty much keep doing what we're doing. We might have to add a little natural gas peaking plant or something like that. Yeah, I don't see us doing much with it either. But when we need it, we need it. And, if I certainly don't object to a visit with the companies, and if at $300,000 they would be supportive, but at $400,000 they just couldn't anymore, then, I think we would work to keep it within that range. But if it's down at $175,000, I'm just not sure we're not getting ourselves into something that we won't have the capability to do well.
Yeah, based on the conversation, this feels to me like we're putting the cart ahead of the horse. We don't know exactly what we're going to do with it. We don't know exactly how much to charge. We don't know. We haven't even reached out to get potential bids. You've got one arguably unique circumstance in Wyoming, or is it unique? We have all these questions, and then we're going to go to the legislature and say, well, we want this, without even knowing exactly what we're going to do with it.
And we've been waiting and dinking around with this for years now.
Okay, so what are we going to do with it?
This is a great start. This gets us money, and it gives us the ability, the flexibility to do it. All those other things depend on the case. They depend on the issues. They depend on so many things. They're always going to change. If we wait another 2 years, we might as well just take whatever Minnesota's given us, because we've got no leverage to tell them otherwise. Nothing.
Yeah, I think this is the time to strike.
I mean, this, it just allows us to do it. It gives us the money to do it. I mean, we already do it. It just gives us money so we can review it and have some sort of feedback that's meaningful to the companies, that's based on facts that we've uncovered as a result of our review. I mean, it is really important that we start doing this stuff.
Would you object to having a visit with them, since you had a previous one, and pointing out how this consultant situation, and see what they would be amenable to? I think the rest of the bill is all fine. It's just the number that we're right. talking about.
Well, unless maybe I misunderstood, but we're not bound by what the Minnesota Commission comes up with. If that's the direction,
we get
the company,
them in an ADP though. When the company's already way down the road.
But let's just say the Minnesota Commission said a resource addition through the IRP process is prudent. And we look at it through the ADP and we say, no, it's not in our eyes. I don't think we slow Excel down a whole heck of a lot because we're 5.5%, maybe 6 at the most. I think they're going to do whatever they're going to do, whether we say yes or no. We're not bound by a decision another commission makes.
But we can't look at the issues on a whole. So we get a 2,000 megawatt wind portfolio, and that comes in with an $85 million savings. And that doesn't include increases to the transmission rider and this, that, and the other, and the retirement of the coal facility and what those depreciation schedules still contain that we have to apply to. I mean, we can't see the whole thing. And so we can't provide the kind of input back to these companies that I think the legislators, the policy leaders in the state, and our ratepayers want us to be doing.
Yeah.
When the resource mix is changing so dramatically every day, and we just don't really have a fingerprint to put on this stuff. We're kind of takers.
And when we deal with it strictly in an ADP, we're kind of constrained to that specific case, not how it's going to affect the whole company. So this one, with blinders on to everything else they're doing, might make sense. And same with this one, and same with this one. But if in the IRP process we put an umbrella over all of them and look at them all together, then they may not make sense anymore.
And that's where I think the trade-offs
potentially beneficial.
I understand the ADP process, but or the IRP plans and how, I think just common sense would say how you look at them. It's a holistic approach versus one at a time on these particular resources. But I think the companies wouldn't push back on 300. I don't think they'd push back on whatever. No, I don't have a number, but just those are the numbers I heard floating out there. But I think they will want a definitive answer on how the IRP is viewed, and I just don't want to be bound by something that we review every 2 years that seems to change overnight.
I'm not following what you think that you're going to want.
Oh, I know companies, ultimately in Excel, what they would really like is approval of an IRP that they present, or approval with, you know, exceptions X, Y, and Z, or whatever they are. That's what they want. They want to basically replace the ADP process with an IRP process instead, and get rid of ADPs. From what I've heard them say in various meetings, that's what they want. They want something definitive, and do we want to do that?
This doesn't take us down that path, though, does it?
It would not require us to do any sort of approval.
No,
it's just an investigation.
So everyone has, goes into this eyes wide open. That's Victor, do you think that's what an Excel wants? Ultimately, I mean, if they could have what their preference might be.
Well, I think they're looking for some advanced certainty on things. You know, the ADP process gives them certainty. This would give them even earlier certainty potentially. where they could know in advance, how should we propose this new resource for the entire system, just for Minnesota?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what they're looking for. I mean, the RTF docket that that Julie referenced is what led us here, ultimately. And I think during that process, I got the impression from NSP they're very willing to give us whatever resources we would like monetarily. That's why the RTF docket is a conglomeration of however many case numbers it is, so that we got a larger filing fee.
If I remember the discussion with the RTF, there was, to a large extent, at least whether they mentioned or not, one thing they kept bringing up was the fact that they would like some sort of input from us, so that as they move forward, they can change their proposal for Minnesota. I do recollect that specifically. Yes. So obviously an approval would be ideal for them because they'd know exactly what we'd want. However, any indication from us, they always said, would be very helpful. And also that allows them, especially on the further down the timing, on the planning timeline, again, from the RTF, it allowed them to evaluate what they really need to do with the system to even remain compliant under our statutory framework. And that's what the concept was with pseudo-separation or full separation, or maybe we can maintain a mostly fully integrated system with minor resource adjustments. And at least when we'd be looking on the further down the timeline, past 2, 3 to 5 years, we'd be able to see at what point the seams and the stressing points between the two jurisdictions would appear.
Well, I'd be willing to even, when do these have to be?
December 4th.
December, okay. So I'll reach out to, I'll probably just get in touch with Carly, because she kind of represents them all, and she can talk through it and then let us know if $300,000 would be fine. I think we should just go for that and see if that's an acceptable level. And I'm also okay with proposing it and letting them make the argument that it should be less, and we can make the argument for it too. I'm not opposed to that, but I think it would be smarter strategically to try to get them on board. It'd
be nice if we all agreed, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So as it is, we're just going to evaluate at what point what's the acceptable amount and then plug that number in and proceed,
yeah,
or
we'll
is that
what
we're
their
at?
Feedback is to that $300,000. I mean, is your thought you want to pull it, Brian, as an agency bill?
No, I want to be better prepared. It just doesn't.
Okay, tell us what that means. What do you want added to better prepare us?
Again, just to repeat what I said earlier, what's the takeaway? What does the $300,000 do? Utilities are going to want certainty, which almost pushes it to an approval process. I mean, what do we do? Do we say, well, everything we think looks reasonable except X, Y, and Z, so we're not going to approve the IRP. But these are the areas that are problematic in terms of the analysis, which, you know, there's some right now with the IRP that's, you know, being reviewed. It's been reviewed for a long time because it takes a long time. Seems like you're going to charge that much. You should have some definitive answers on what the deliverable is for the $300,000, and it seems vague to me.
Well, it's not necessarily the company footing that bill by itself. I mean, the ratepayers ultimately end up paying that.
Right.
And obviously, they only pay what we use of that, you know.
And we've always taken that into consideration as we've been moving forward with the cases and trying to minimize that cost of ratepayers every chance we can.
Well, yes. And it feels like we would be establishing the framework when we see the case come in and staff reviews it and says, we have some concerns in this area, this area, this area. We'd like to explore it more. We think we should review this one. And you'd make a proposal, I would assume, to us, or maybe you'd just go ahead and make that assessment yourself and assess the filing fee. I don't know how that would work, but then you'd get what you get, and we'd go from there and provide our comments back on the on the plan. And we could have any number of options. We could say, absolutely, under no circumstances will we accept solar that is not at market value or, you know, cost effective. We could make any number of. I think it's impossible to say what we would be saying and how at this point. It just allows us to review their resource plans and establish criteria that we think is right for our customers.
Yeah. I would also like to point that really this is oriented to be an enabling statute. It allows us to adopt rules and regulations as we go forward. So if you decide how we'd like to proceed with this, if there are specific items that we would like to see in the future as we're starting to move into this, allow us that ability to really expound upon it and set a little more policy as it relates to filing of integrated resource plans. So it's that's worth considering as well. So I know that it's not, we want absolute clarity, but the way it's written as it is, it enables us to set that clarity moving forward as well, as with a lot of different enabling statutes that we have.
Move forward with it and see if we can come up with something more definitive in terms of what will actually, you know, what companies, i.e. ratepayers, get for the expense.
Sure. And I guess we could have further conversations, and Victor, I'm sure, would be happy to be involved with that to try to, even if we don't in the statute have that type of structure, it sounds like you would like to have at least the ability to communicate what we're envisioning moving forward.
Yeah, it seems to me like the answer. It seems to me that the answer would be, you know, in terms of, you know, what does this accomplish, and it gives a general sense of direction of, you know, in terms of how the commission may currently view the IRP. While expressing any specific concerns that are part of that IRP.
When I've talked about this to legislators, it's been overwhelmingly positive, and they think it's a good idea for us to start weighing in on what we think the resource mix should be for our citizens in a more meaningful way, and that's as far as I've mentioned it, and I don't know that they expect a lot more specificity than that. So I wouldn't really want to be more specific in the law, but I'm totally open to discussing the rules and stuff whenever that's appropriate.
Sure. Well, I think if we're able to achieve this, it's going to be a developing or evolving part of our workload, and so to be able to sit and write it out exactly what we're going to do and how it's going to come out would be, I think, impossible. I think we're going to have to leave ourselves some flexibility to figure this out as we go.
Yeah.
Other states have been doing it for, I don't know, probably decades, certainly years, and we're entering into it new.
How long has Wyoming done it?
I think this is the first one.
Mm-hmm.
This is a reaction to what's happening with their coal industry, I would imagine.
Well, to their regulated utility industry, they want to make sure that their ratepayers are going to have a resource plan that is the best for them for the long term, as opposed to just the first thing that the company came up with.
Mm-hmm. And my impression with this is that whatever amount we set it at, it wouldn't be a flat fee that automatically gets submitted. It would be when staff determines that there is a need to do an evaluation, and then you would further specify like how much money. It wouldn't automatically be the top amount, right? There'd be that flexibility.
Would work like cases, so like ADPs and rate cases,
they by default have the $175,000 filing fee.
Yeah.
But so do riders. And on those cases, we specify in the motions that we're reducing the filing fee to generally $10,000 sure. in those cases, just to cover notices and the like.
Yeah.
So yes, it would work
case
similarly.
By case. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. Why haven't we taken a deeper dive into riders in terms of, we do reduce it to 10. How come we've never, has there been an example where there's been a deeper dive in terms of asking for more money and then actually shopping it out to a consulting firm to see if this component fits into
the plan? The riders are generally just the annual updates.
Right.
So we don't have the time necessary, I think, first of all, to get an expert on hired. You know, it takes at least 2 months just to hire one, like from the first day that we decide we're going to hire someone or we should hire someone until we can get a contract in place. It's about 2 months. That's the shortest we've been able to narrow it up to. And then you're talking, you know, notice periods and testimony, rebuttal testimony, you know, the rider proceedings don't have that timeline built in. Most of them are filed contemplating that they'll be approved within 3 months, if not less in some cases, versus, you know, the cases where we generally hire experts, the ADPs and the rate cases, we have usually 7 months in those situations. And honestly, a lot of times that's just barely enough, if not never enough. I think since I've been here, I don't believe we finished an ADP or a rate case within the 7 months from filing date to order date. Now, the company's always agreed to the extension for those, but 7 months is not as long as it seems.
All right. Well, I guess I'll plan on proceeding then. I think we have a little bit of direction. Julie's going to reach out to the utilities.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, so moving on, and there are two specific sections from 4922.25 and 4922.1 and 22, and they're the exact same. And that was the only item that changed in this current bill as it is from our previous discussions. And that this is relates to the approval of temporary operation or variance. So if you did one in front of you, it would be 4922.25. If you recall, in addition to the showing of good cause or receipt of a utility certification that the activities will have no adverse impacts upon the welfare of the citizens of the state or the environment, we also required a number of different filings and notifications and so forth. And we did receive a little bit of feedback about really the purpose of that. And so as a result of that, and of course our discussion and some of the feedback you provided, I just dialed it back to those two items because really that's the very purpose of the Siting Act, minimal adverse effects, and ultimately they have to have a good cause to have a temporary operation from that. And what that provides is the company would be able to provide whatever they feel justifies a temporary variance. And it also, from our standpoint, provides the opportunity to request any additional information that we require in order to make our determination without really setting anything set forth in stone. And so really it's maybe a little more flexible of an approach. And I guess I'd be interested to see if any of you have any concerns or thoughts from our previous meeting regarding those changes.
I do not.
So the key language is on page 9, Jack?
Page 9, that's correct. Sub 1.
And before, did we have a lot more language in there?
Yes, yeah. There was a whole listing of about numbers, I think 5 or 6 things that we had, including notification to landowners and so forth.
Yeah.
And so.
You guys are, I'm good with this. I like this a little better, but you guys are fine with it.
Well, I'm comfortable just from the standpoint of there are any of those items that we feel we need, we can always
request
them. So.
Yeah, I like it.
Okay.
I didn't think this would take longer than the hour we set aside. I have another commitment.
Sure.
I wonder if we could do the auctioneers first before we do any more.
Sure. We only have the auctioneers and that the wind items left. So I guess
okay,
we want to hop to the okay. Seeing no concerns with that change, I'll move to 49-2207, and that'll be in the following bill. So in this bill, 49-2207, this is the repowering bill. And as it is right now, we made a couple of adjustments, and Brian and I discussed it. Previously, we had required local approval for any sort of variance. Instead of that, we moved it back to an additional line on the end saying a requested variance must comply with local land use, zoning, building rules, regulations, and ordinances. And that actually reflects other areas in the Siting Act. And when the Siting Act directly relates to and interacts with local authorities. And it also still allows a variance for impacts to exclusions and avoidance areas resulting from the repowering of the existing infrastructure.
Jack, what page are you on?
I don't think there's actually a page number on this one. This is after the siting bills.
Okay.
About right the fourth one from two. The end.
Sorry, I should have broke this down.
I found it.
Okay.
I was heading the wrong direction.
So if you walk through this one, it's very similar to the last copy. It just provides some additional clarifications in how it's going to apply. I will express that I did receive some feedback from various stakeholders in the industry. The wind group, they provided that they really didn't have concern with this. I think specifically there are two entities that may have some sort of concern with it, and that'd be NextEra and Acciona. And a couple of the concerns I think that they have would be that we didn't define repowering. And then they also had concerns as it relates to existing facilities, which we don't believe there are going to be a lot of them, but if there is one that's going to be repowered and setbacks have changed, how would that ultimately be addressed? And in my viewpoint, I was assuming that they could provide a good showing of good cause and get a variance from that exclusion and avoidance area. Of course, that would require coming from the commission and getting some sort of approval for that.
So, which is probably appropriate at that point, right?
If it impacts maybe a non-participating landowner, that would be a good reason to.
I mean, it would provide the opportunity for that. It wouldn't require it.
Right. So are there any concerns with this one? Speaking with NextEra, I provided that if they would like to provide us any sort of amendments or suggestions, I'd be happy to hear them. And specifically a definition of repowering, I don't think that is something that we're looking to have to be a difficult or complex thing to negotiate. I think we'll probably be on the same page if we can, with the same definition.
Should we be defining that? Repowering?
Well, sure.
Go ahead, Jack. Sorry.
Well, from an agency standpoint, I didn't think it was necessary. If the industry feels that's something that needs to be defined, I think that's something we certainly could take a look at. And I don't think that's something that we would necessarily be opposed to. Just from our standpoint, that's not something we need. If it's regular maintenance or anything like that, I think that would just be something we wouldn't request a siting.
Could there be, without a definition, could there be an instance where we think it's repowering and they're like, well, no, it isn't. This is just changing out the blades.
Well, right. I think that's what they're concerned of.
Yeah.
Well, I'm guessing, though, you know, if a blade is just getting bad and they replace it with the same kind of a blade, or while they're at it, replace all three of them, is that repowering, or is it only repowering if they add longer blades and make it a more powerful generator? I don't know exactly where the line is.
Yeah, after adding bigger blades and not changing the output, which one of them just did, right? Added bigger blades, but didn't change the nameplate.
Right.
That was a repowering, I feel like, yeah.
They just used turbines, I think, from like 47 to 43 or 51 to 47 or something.
Depending on how they would want to define it, we might have take objection to the definition, yeah. but I don't see that it would hurt to define it.
Probably
so
wouldn't.
You have repowering, hard, and then though. It seems to me like you have refurbishing, which is different.
Yeah.
Like we refurbish the counters, but we don't.
Well, the interesting is we're discussing a definition for probably at max two wind farms out there at the end of the day. So it's not like we're going to get 10 sure. repowerings of facilities and then have to make a number of apply the law a number of times. It'll probably twice.
Yes.
Yeah. Just a good point. If we haven't needed to define it for other things, maybe we shouldn't mess around with it for this.
I think the companies define repowering based on whatever tax code is to get the, the PTCs. No, seriously.
Probably true, yeah.
They're going to meet the requirements to, quote, repower because then they can collect a new round of
Well, I'm okay with this as written.
Okay.
I'm sure if they want a definition in real bad, they'll come with an amendment, too.
Sure. Yeah.
Go back to the federal definition.
Well, if they do, if we do work together and we can provide some sort of definition of repowering, I'll make sure that provide a notification and maybe have some, a little bit further discussion on that specific item as we move forward. I know they said they'd be reaching out to me in the next couple of weeks to have a little more discussion on that. All right, and the next one is light mitigation technology, and there are no changes to that one.
No, my last version had these two things together.
Right.
Right, okay.
And, yeah, so as it currently is, it's one single bill with these two items. There was some discussion that maybe it'd be worthwhile due to the controversial nature of these two to split them off, just so not to have to work around multiple issues. But these are both wind issues specifically. I think that's why we initially was speaking with Commissioner Christman, put them together.
Yeah. But I think these two are more likely to have controversy surround them. And so I think it was important to separate them from that bigger bill on 4922 and 22.1. And
agreed.
So I think this is a good proposal.
Okay, the 911 thing is the same, right?
Yep. Nothing new with the one call. So this moves on to Commissioner Christman's auctioneers and clerk licenses.
So this has a few changes in it, but there's a lot more options that I just wanted to find out what you guys thought. So what this does is, in subsection 1 there, the second to the last line, the January 1st instead of 31st, that's important, I think, to Conrad and Shelley. Basically, the deadline to get relicensed is January 1st, but the late fee isn't till January 31st, and it just doesn't make sense, and so it just fixes that.
Mm-hmm.
And then so auctioneer bonds are $5,000, and clerks are $10,000. Those have not been elevated for decades. I see the clerking as a more significant need for bonding, and so this raises that from $10,000 to $20,000. I did talk to someone who is in the business of selling these bonds with a company that is frequently used. Their cost for bonds for that particular company is $5 per thousand with a $100 minimum. So if they didn't change anything, $20,000 would cost the same as $10,000.
Yeah.
But
the minimum.
He did point out that their price was kind of set about the same time as our law, so if we change the law, they might change their minimum.
Oh.
But we can't know that. But I think it's important. I had Jill do a value of the dollar calculator on it, and from when $10,000 was set to be equal in buying power, it should be $26,000 now.
Mm.
So I think that's a modest increase. I did not make a move on changing the auctioneer bonds because it's just I don't really see where we're likely to use them. I'm going to come back to that, though, in a moment. But I just will say, for my part, we could even eliminate that language and not have the auctioneer bonds. But I want to point down at the bottom of that first page, there's a little subsection 1. That is the key language in our auctioneer licensing, that we make sure that we grant these licenses to people of good reputation for honesty, truthfulness, and fair dealing, and who are competent to transact this business. I think a much more efficient way of doing that than just whoever the bonding companies will accept $100 from is for us to do a background check. And Conrad found a way that doesn't cover much that we can do through BCI, a more complex alternative through the FBI, but then ends up taking some time. Jack is familiar with, but I can't explain it. But I've had it explained to me. Like something we could subscribe to and do our own pretty thorough background checks. We could subscribe to this for less than $3,000 a year. And then we would know if they have been convicted of crimes or fraud or things like that. And I think that is much more in line with what the law assigns us to do than just requiring this bond. Then if we wanted to charge something extra to make that up, we could address it in the licensing fee if you wanted to raise that. Or when we did our other fee increases on our budget bill, there was some discussion of why we're not addressing this. I guess now if we want to increase it, now is the time to talk about it, both in conjunction with this subscription service for background checks, as well as just in fairness that it has been $35 for many, many years. And in a moment, I'll have that. That's been since 1987. And the clerk bond has been since also 1987. And the last thing I wanted to tell you was that subscription fee, if I did my math right and remembered what Jack had told me the monthly fee was, it would come to $2,928 per biennium. The $35 fee for relicensing each year, and now this is per year, comes out to $16,625. Oh, that's a rough estimate of the number of licensees. So you're talking $15,000-$18,000 per year. So if we were to put in legislation like we did with some other things where that would stay within the agency for our services, it would raise a little over $30,000 a biennium. If we increase it, you can figure it out from there.
So what would, just to say, like, we covered the cost of that licensing or that service, what is it, $2,000 by name? About?
Yeah.
2,000.
Divided by
almost
how many?
Yeah.
Divided by 3. Divided by how many licenses a biennium?
Between 450 and 500. It would be about $5 a piece or six or seven.
So if you raise it to like $50 or whatever, it would cover some of our time too.
If we are keeping it.
Yeah.
Although, I mean, not if we don't, it goes to the general fund and the legislature appropriates its money.
Money for the subscription.
I'm thinking since that fee hasn't been increased since 1987, and out of the whole country, I think there's only 4 that I found that charge less than 100. I would think we would probably go up to like 70 or something like that. Or
I think it's good to do something more to ensure that we're doing evaluating the reputation for honesty, truthfulness, and fair dealing. And I think the background checks are pretty easy nowadays, so that seems like a bare minimum that we should probably be doing.
The subscription I'm looking at is almost instantaneous. It'd probably be within an hour we get an answer.
Yeah. And when, like, as an example, my husband and I have an apartment, and we do background checks on our renters, and we charge them for it as a part of their application process. So I think it's just normal. That should be covered in our fee.
And I will say then, I think in fairness, Conrad likes having also the bonding company looking at him too.
Yeah.
So I think he likes keeping that $5,000 bond. I don't think he does. I know he does. For my part, we could eliminate it, so I'm bringing it to you. I don't feel real strongly one way or the other, but when we talk about potentially increasing the license fees from, say, 35 to 70, so these auctioneers are paying $100 a year for their bond. And so if we increase their fees but eliminate that $5,000 bond, we're actually saving them money.
I personally would be hesitant to take away the bond, because just when you take it away, there's going to be a case and someone's going to have need it. And then it'll be like, oh, the commission actually advocated to get rid of the bond that would have provided protection for us.
It's possible.
So I don't like that scenario at all. If we were going to go that route, then I'd be looking for like an industry entity to and be advocating for self-regulating. Like, let's go over to the auctioneer board and have them be the ones managing this whole program. They can decide how they want to protect the public.
Well, I don't feel very strongly about it. I'm okay with leaving it if that's what you guys prefer. But would you like to do like we're doing with the clerks and maybe double that one too and go to $10,000 on that one? That one is a little bit newer. That one moved to $5,000 in 1993.
Wow. And is it the same, $5 per 100 or something like that? Or $5?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it'd be an extra $25 a year.
No, it's $5
minimum
per 1,000.
Oh.
So
oh.
A pretty good chance it won't impact their cost.
Minimum of 100 probably.
Yeah, wouldn't that be $5 a 1,000? And if it goes from 5 to 10, wouldn't that be $25?
It said for they have a $100 minimum.
Oh, they do too. So not just clerks, but...
Just for clarification, too, Shelley, a lot of times the auction clerk and the auctioneer are the same person.
Yeah.
Okay.
Why wouldn't we just raise it to, I mean, what they're the same as we're approaching the clerks? Or just the perception of it doesn't cost them anymore, but doesn't that look better?
Based on that warning that my source told me that when we change our law, they'll probably change their minimum. And so... that's probably going to happen anyway. They're looking for a reason to change their minimum. And so if we're like quadrupling it, then it'll probably shift the blame to us, I guess.
But it doesn't cost them anymore.
Well, depends on if the bonding company raises the minimum. With the current pricing schedule, it wouldn't cost them
anymore. You said you just talked to one bonding company, or are they all...
I talked to a person who sells bonds for one bonding company, yeah. But I checked our bond that people got with several different companies, and they all were $100. So I think that minimum is a pretty much an industry standard.
Interesting. I'll go with whatever you think.
I like the auction clerk stuff. I like raising the licensing fee and doing the background checks. I kind of like Brian's idea of doubling the bond for the auctioneer.
So take it to 10.
Yeah.
That was Randy's idea.
I thought you said, why wouldn't we double it? I'm sorry.
No, I'm talking from the 10 to 20.
Oh, okay.
That's what I was talking about, just because it doesn't cost any more. But
yeah,
if they're... it's a fear that the bonding company would try and seize the opportunity and then
and that's
the same exact situation we're in now all over again.
Yeah. And a lot of these companies have four or five auctioneers, and so then it's multiplied by all them, where the clerk license is one license for however many.
And my only concern with all this is there really isn't anything triggering us to do this other than we're trying to be proactive and seeing that it's been a long time since this has been updated. Correct?
Kind of proactive.
Like
27 years proactive.
Yeah.
Well, time to update it. We don't want to wait till there's a bad case.
Until someone who's got a real record of fraud and we licensed them.
Right.
That's really the biggest thing. But also in our discussion on whether some of these fees that the agency collects should be kept here to run our agency.
Yeah.
We also need to decide if we're going to raise this, to what amount, and do we include that language where the money stays within the agency?
70, and yes, that's what I vote for.
Well, good part as well. Be good for another several decades now.
So you're good with that?
Okay. Sorry, I didn't get. So it is $70. There were
$70, and that same language is with weights and measures. Then, or that language should apply to this section.
Keeping it.
Okay, for the budgeting, and that's for the budget bill. You're saying okay. Because that wouldn't be in.
That's for you, Jim.
That won't be in this bill.
For your listing.
Gotcha. So for the purpose of this one, we don't need to do anything for the background checks because that's kind of been implied. Increase in bonding and increase in licensing fees are the changes that need to be done.
Right.
Okay.
Yep.
Hey,
we made quick.
And changing that date for the late fee.
Right, and changing the data. Sorry, missed that one. So I
Brian,
think
you lied.
I had one general question. Did, and Jack has assured me, but I'm just clarifying because I don't just do not recall this. Or we're not going with legislation to make the rail safety program permanent at this time?
Well, wait. There was something...
In the very first legislative meeting, yeah, I came with a draft for to make it permanent, and we were told, I was given direction to not pursue it, making it permanent. And we would continue to address it in the...
The budget.
The budget. The same way we're currently are doing it.
Is that changing?
Yeah. That
from the governor's budget and...
It wasn't that we don't want it to be permanent. We want it to be permanent, but there was some... There was two ways to go about it, right? I can't remember this. I remember the discussion, but I don't remember the details about why I really felt like the way that it was laid out in the legislation was kind of creating a... Wouldn't it drive it to a policy committee? And the way we do it now, it's part of our budget.
Okay. That's my recollection of why we chose to do it that way.
I mean, we'll still be advocating for it to be permanent, but through the budget process, not...
Okay, as long as something didn't fall through the cracks.
As a policy bill.
It is interesting. So there isn't. Is there a change package in place for that? I'm trying to remember. To make it permanent.
I don't know how we go about that. Through that. We'd have to talk to Jill, but that's a good point. Is she listening in? Oh, there's no open line.
I think we should just make sure that we're consistent with how we approached it last time so it doesn't look like we've softened or backed off at all.
Right, for sure.
I'll listen back to that original meeting, too, and just make sure I think my notes are long gone from midsummer. But I think it was a pretty short discussion. I think it was one of the first things we discussed in that meeting as well.
I really think on that subject, if we're going to be successful, we need to recruit some legislators who are going to advocate for that.
Yeah.
I don't think we are going to persuade them alone.
Well, and I mean, to the extent that Gary Lee and I mean, there were some pretty good ones in appropriations. It's just, it was the Senate versus the House.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So we need some House legislators.
Yeah.
And it depends on, I mean, the House Appropriations Chair was never going to go for it. The previous one. If that is different now, there might be a slightly new opening.
I think Senator Lee, Grabinger, and I think even Senator Wanzek were supportive.
Yeah, they all were over there. Yeah. So is, I mean, Michael Howe, he's in the House. He might be actually a good one. I've talked to him. He's supportive of the program. So
we're kind of wrapped up here?
I think so.
He'd be perfect.
Yeah.
It's his district.
Right. Thanks, Randy. Okay.
Anything else, Jack?
No, that's all of it.
I know we've already covered this, but can I ask this one question again? And it's unrelated to what we discussed. It's about the where we hold the public hearings. What page is that?
I remember now.
Page 12. Is this?
No, I remembered the rail thing. Now I have it. Okay.
Oh,
page 12.
Public hearings.
Sure.
Commission determines there's an emergency.
Oh, I gotta stand up. I'm standing up.
Did we? Trying to remember as well. I mean, is emergency, is that, that's very broad, right?
Yes.
So emergency or extenuating circumstances that would prevent, or is emergency good?
But I think we previously discussed whether to add additional language in there, and I think ultimately, at least in the last meeting, no one, there wasn't an ultimate recommendation to change that. The extenuating circumstances, I think it would probably have to be, I mean, if we want to put it in or extenuating circumstances, we could. But I don't think there are many. So holding the public hearing in the location has always been something that we always felt was very important as a commission. And to really deviate from that, we always felt that it had to be something not just minor, because, for example, an extenuating circumstance might be weather or so forth, or maybe just conflict of commission schedules for all that. So really we're trying to tie it really to something that was important that would prevent us from doing that. And additionally, when you toss it together with the publication requirements, it would almost have to be something that's very clearly a well-known emergency ahead of time, because we wouldn't be able to change it last second and change the publication for the public to hold a remote hearing.
So a blizzard would be an emergency, or?
I think that, again, a blizzard, unless we knew a blizzard was coming 20 days in advance, would be very difficult to publish ahead of time and make sure that the public knows that we're going to hold a remote hearing.
What if we, now this is just going down a different direction, but it, as Brian and I have often said, we think we should be doing them so that people can participate electronically no matter whether we are there or not.
Sure.
So if we go and start doing that,
mm-hmm.
and we notice it that way across, always, that, you know, you will be able to dial in and participate in this manner.
Sure.
And then if there's a blizzard and we can't get there, couldn't we have it here and still have it be a public hearing?
There's an argument to be made that as long as we have a physical presence there, and that doesn't mean
you, Brian out there.
That doesn't mean you three, or doesn't mean you, right.
Done it before,
right?
Yeah. I remember that argument. Right. No,
we'll deputize every county commissioner.
Right. Well, there have been quite a few times the commission. Well, quite a few. There have been three times that the commission hasn't showed up for a siting hearing, and we just sent staff up separately to hold the hearing.
Yeah.
Individually or with an ALJ.
Yeah, substantive ALJ.
Yes, substantive ALJ in those situations normally.
So what's the answer if?
So would we be able to do that? We still have to send a staff person there, is what you're saying. We couldn't just say we're having it here, like we're not, like the electronic hearing is the hearing.
You know, if we sent up someone to physically set it up so that we could hold a physical location of a hearing, I think there's an argument to be made that that would constitute a public hearing in that location. But I guess when it comes to something very procedural, which is the easiest way to lose on an appeal, we always just err on the side of doing it absolutely correct.
Yeah.
Sooner or later,
that way.
In this part of the world, sooner or later, that will happen, where it's a raging blizzard, but we've clearly demonstrated that we can hold effective hearings remotely. It's not preferable,
mm-hmm.
but as long as that's, quote, an emergency, which it would be. I mean, if you can't travel, roads are closed, but everything's lined up, we've noticed it. You know, in extreme instances like that, you know, the show must go on.
Be nice, but what you're saying is we couldn't unless we could get a staff member there.
That would be the best case scenario, that we'd actually have a physical presence there.
Back to deputizing.
I'm an excellent snowmobile driver.
Tweaked.
Yeah.
Sorry. I think it's
that. How would that read? How would you have to tweak the language?
Emergency or weather-related event?
But we still have to have the hearing, the notices.
That we still need
to get rid of that.
We still need the publication.
Yeah.
Requirements.
So that the publication notice is what gets us for the weather related stuff. Sounds like. Unless we can send somebody up there. Snowmobile. Ride in a snowplow truck.
Yeah, I'm just going through scenarios. Sure. Saying interstate was close from Bismarck to Jamestown. The hearing was in Fargo.
Right.
Mm-hmm. We can't get there. You hate to have to go through the entire process all over again.
Yeah, we've done it. What was that one wind farm?
Maricourt.
Three times.
Yeah, terrible. One time we held it and the notice wasn't done published correctly, and we had to redo
it, and then we had a weather.
Yep, there's a blizzard.
Yeah. And we had to reschedule it.
Yikes. That one was a nightmare.
Okay. All right, thanks.
Oh, on the rail stuff, this is what I remember now. What Conrad had thought was we could potentially add language requiring us to have a rail program, a rail safety program, put it into law that we have a rail safety program.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's currently not in law. It says that we can get involved in rail safety or whatever, but it doesn't say that we have to have a rail safety program. So he was suggesting we could just add it in there like we have other programs designated in law. And I thought that was taking it a step too far, because then, you know, every program that we do isn't in law, and it does take away the discretion then that maybe down the road there isn't a need for the rail safety program. I'm not saying I see that day, but maybe.
Mm-hmm.
So do you have to prescribe it in the century code? Then in order to get rid of it, you have to change the law.
I think, and I remember, I believe the concept was if we put it in statute as in this is a permanent program at that point in time, then it would have to be funded, I think, was the alternative.
Yeah.
So since that's where that would give that sense of permanency.
Yes.
Whereas now we may not in the future. So at any point in time, the legislature could just not fund that portion.
Right. Well, and permanent, and right now it sunsets in our funding. And
mm-hmm.
So we've always just sought to get rid of that sunset as the way to make it permanent versus adding policy language in the century code to make it permanent. We've never done what you and Conrad had talked about. We've always just, like, if we could get rid of the sunset language, we're good.
Sure.
Then it doesn't have
in the budget bill.
Yeah, in the budget bill. Or someplace in our bill. Yeah.
Budget bill. Just got a message from her director who questioned whether or not the budget is modifiable at this point.
Ooh. Well, are we modifying the budget? Oh, the auctioneer stuff.
Well, that was just for the purpose of this. That's all that was really.
Well, yeah, that's
right.
That, but we do, there was a component of that was budget related.
Yeah, there was.
I don't know the answer to that.
Above my pay grade.
I think everything's changeable. Just depends on how and when. I mean, we can always just make that on the fly in our budget presentation.
I think I read that, you know, some list of things. It was a Scandinavian thing where I think it had to do with a husband and a wife, and then that rules were subject to change based on little or no notice, and it wasn't in our favor. So
that's how things go right in our house. But not just from the wife.
Okay. I think we're wrapped up. Okay, done. Okay, thanks, Matt. Thanks, everyone.